I want to continue with the theme that I've been working with and sort of bring it out maybe to some kind of culmination at this point, which was the two wings of enlightenment, which turned into the six perfections. And then the last thing we talked about last week was about habits and how samskaras, and how a lot of what Buddhist practice is about is looking at our habits and the transformation of habits, the creation of positive habits and the reduction of negative habits. And in what I was talking about, I kind of worked to the point of saying that all these habits, whether positive or negative, are based upon certain ideas of what's going on, that the underlying root of everything that causes us to react is certain assumptions about what's real and what's going on in the world around us. And we're mostly not aware of how those assumptions operate, if we're even aware that they're there, and that those assumptions then structure how we react to the world and what we do. And over a period of time, the how we react and what we do is what forms the various habits. And if we think about what our personality is, our personality, what we think of as being me, is, if we were to describe ourselves, would mostly be what's the shape and condition of our bodies right now, because that's always involved in me, and then what's our personality? I mean, you know, what makes me different from Kayla is, well, obviously we have different bodies, but we also have different personalities. And beyond those things, what is there that would make us different from each other? I mean, I would be very hard-pressed to answer that question, because, I mean, in a fundamental sense, the fact of our being aware is pretty much the same. I mean, she's aware, I'm aware, and it's the way in which we're aware that's different. It's not the fact that we're aware, if this makes any sense. And the way that we're aware of being different, or the way we perceive being different, is a matter of our personalities, our body, and our history. So, that kind of complex of habits and and suppositions about what's going on are sort of the essential thing that Buddhist practice is about. Because it's our habitual reactions to things that make us unhappy. It's our habitual reactions to things that make us happy. So cultivating the habits that have positive outcomes is a good thing. Cultivating the habits that have negative outcomes is not a good thing. But fundamentally, they're all still the same. So you know, it's like a bird can be in an iron cage or a golden cage. Okay, so good habits are like the golden cage, and bad habits are like the iron cage. Maybe that's not the best metaphor. But, you know, in a sense, what makes us happy and what makes us unhappy is still the same process, although we'd obviously rather be happy than unhappy. But it's still the same process. And what drives the process, and this is what I want to get to, is the way in which we construe the world we live in. Now, so pardon me if I get this wrong, because I'm not a Christian, but my understanding is that in the Christian worldview, the fundamental problem is the fall of man, woman, or original sin, or something along those lines. I mean, in the Christian worldview, there's an original problem, and the original problem has put us in this pickle we're in, right, to simplistic theology. The original problem, however you describe it, put us in the fundamental pickle, okay? And then you know, everything about Christianity then is how do you deal with that? And Christ has something to do with that, and the church has something to do with that, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to get into that too much, but actually if you look at most religions have this idea that there's a sort of a problem which leads to a pickle, and then religion is about getting out of the pickle. Okay, so Buddhism is no different in that respect. However, the fundamental problem is called misunderstanding or ignorance. And the pickle that we're in is not knowing what's going on in truth. We have a perception of what appears to be going on, and on the basis of our perceptions of what appears to be going on, we react in certain ways which either reinforce positive habits or reinforce negative habits. But what the underlying process is that we have a way of construing what's going on around us, and that's what underlies all the habit patterns of how we react. So I don't know. I think I'm explaining this, but I don't know how clear it is. So let's sort of hold it at that for the moment. Well, I'll give a specific example. It comes from my undergraduate days when I was studying psychology. So this is the 1960s, so this is a pretty old experiment. But some guys had the idea that they would ask poor kids to draw dimes, quarters, and hamburgers. Dimes, quarters, and hamburgers. Don't ask me. Dimes, quarters, and hamburgers. And they asked relatively upper middle class and well-to-do kids to draw dimes, quarters, and hamburgers. And what they found was a direct relationship between the wealth of the environment that the kids were growing up in and the size of the dimes, quarters, and hamburgers that they drew. So poor kids, you know, drew bigger hamburgers than wealthy kids, and you can say, well, maybe they're hungry more often. Well, that could be part of it, but they also drew bigger quarters and or bigger dimes or nickels or whatever it was. And the way this was interpreted, and maybe I'm not getting the experiment totally straight, but the way it was interpreted was that the conditions in which people lived and their histories and whatnot shaped their perceptions very profoundly. So this is kind of a simplistic example of what I'm trying to talk about here, is that we don't see things as they are. We see things based upon some presuppositions we have. And what the Buddha taught and what the Buddhist tradition has carried forward is that if you look at how this process works at the deepest levels, you find the fundamental problem that's led to the pickle. So Buddhist original sin is a certain fundamental misunderstanding. And now, different over the centuries, Buddhists have formulated the idea of what this fundamental problem is rather differently, but they've mostly agreed on certain elements of it. And the shape of the fundamental problem is the tendency to, or the habit, or the bias, or the training, or whatever you want to call it, to see things instead of processes. If this makes any sense, okay. For example, there's a table here in front of me. Okay, so you know, in English, that's a noun. It's not a verb, for one thing. Okay, so English forces us to see this as an object rather than a process. I'm not looking at a tabling phenomenon. I mean, that's the best you could do in English, I think, to turn this thing into a process. All around me, there are things. Even things that we know are processes, like a river. Right? The word river is a noun, but you know, unless it's frozen solid, when you look at it, you can see that there's something dynamic going on. There's constant change going on, even though there's some persistence of a pattern. I mean, there are river banks, but we know the rivers change over time, too. Right? But they don't stay in one place. So the issue here is a matter of time. And if we look at this table, we don't see the table's past. I mean, we don't look at this glass and see silicon going into a furnace, turning it into glass. We just see glass. And we don't see how it got to the furnace. We don't see how it got to this location that was cut by somebody. We just see this glass here. And the same with the wood. I mean, we don't look at the wood and see a tree. Right? And we don't look at the wood and see it turning into compost or kindling for a fire or something like that. We just see the wood right here as part of the table. We don't see anybody putting this together and constructing it and painting it or anything. We just look at it and see it in this moment of time as if it's a thing. But it doesn't take very much for us to look at it a little bit more closely and realize that there really was a process that was associated with this noun that brought it to this place, that there is a, you know, stretched out over time, there was something happening. And we can imagine that. And we can probably imagine where it's going in the future, too. You know, as I said, we can imagine it being kindling or trash or compost or something like that. So that's a very simplistic example of how our perceptions of things are things because we see them out of time. I mean, there was a period of time when this glass was not part of this table, and it was actually not very long ago. I mean, when you look at this table, you see a table, and it has a circle of glass and a wooden perimeter and legs. But actually, when Kay and I found this table in some junk store, it had a piece of wood in the center, and we had to go to a Grand Paint and Glass and have some glass cut to put in the center. And that was only a couple years ago. So what we're looking at here as such, when you first look at it, well, it's always been like that, right? When you look at it, it's always been like that. Well, no, it wasn't always like that, right? A couple years ago, it was really different. And before that, it was really different, and so on and so forth. And, okay. Now, the other thing is when we look at it, what we don't see is we don't see that it's the table is made of parts that are hanging together in the moment. I mean, we don't see that these legs are nailed together and that the glass is balanced on this rim by gravity, which is what's holding it here. So for every moment, the only reason that this glass is sitting on top of this table is because of the ongoing force of gravity. There's actually nothing holding it there. It's not screwed in or nailed on or glued on or anything like that. The legs are screwed together, you know. So it's a complex of parts. But when we look at it, we don't see that it's a complex of parts. The other thing is, when we look at it, the thought table just automatically arises in our mind. We don't look at it and say, oh, that's a tape recorder holder. No, we look at it and see that it's a table, but it is holding a tape recorder. But tape recorder holder or stand doesn't occur to us. From here to here, we have a tape recorder stand, but below this little stand, we have a table. Well, no, actually, the table really is sitting here to hold the tape recorder. It really is a tape recorder stand. It's not a table. Okay? But that's not what occurs to our minds. Okay? So this is a traditional Buddhist analysis that everything that goes on in our world appears one way, but if we actually analyze it closer, it's really quite a different thing that's going on. Because where we draw lines and how we see things in time is, in a certain respect, arbitrary, in another respect, not arbitrary, you know. I mean, you weren't part of the process of Kay and I working on this table, so you don't know its history. So you can only see it as a slice in the present. We have some history with it, so we can see it spread out over, you know, a period of time in the past, and, you know, there's David on the back porch staining it and doing it outside so we don't destroy our lungs, and, you know, there's this whole kind of complicated stuff that's wrapped up in this that we see, but in a moment you don't. Okay, so Buddhists have this analysis about everything that's going on in the world around them, and you might think on the whole that that's kind of trivial, but really you can look at other things and you can see how it's sort of non-trivial. I mean, you can get into, for example, deep Buddhist economics and think about what's going on in the world. Where do things come from? Where are they going to? How much does anybody really need? What are the actual costs of things in terms of human labor and so on and so forth, which you would tend to not see in any instance of anything, but you can if you want to look at it. So there really is this whole, in fact, Buddhist economics that has grown up out of this way of looking at things. But again, in regards to the table, it's a little bit trivial. But everything in our experience from the Buddhist point of view can be analyzed in this way. And where it gets to be non-trivial is when you start looking at yourself and analyzing yourself that way. Or you look at your wife and analyze her that way. Or anybody that you're engaged with and analyze them that way. Or human beings in general. Then it becomes very non-trivial, right? Because when you look at yourself, for example, you see a whole entity, you don't see parts. And because you see a whole entity and you don't see parts, you tend also not to see change. Change can only occur when parts exist in dynamic relationship with each other. If parts exist in an actual static, unchanging relationship to each other, there can't be any change. Well, so for one thing, Buddhist philosophers assert that that's an impossibility. There's no such thing as a static, unchanging relationship of anything to anything. That's just unreal. Everything is in a dynamic relationship with everything else. So everything you look at is a complex in which all the parts have this dynamic relationship with each other. Well, what that means is that they change. And what that means is that whatever you're experiencing was different in the past and will be different in the future. Now, the past and the future may be pretty far away, but they're there. So, what's the most common experience we have in regards to having a body and being a person? That the past is pretty far away and the future is pretty far away, and the only thing that's real is the present. And that's true. The only thing that's real is the present. But the future and the past are connected to the present in a fundamental way, because the present of my body, the present moment of this complex, which is my body, is a complete result of absolutely 100% of everything that's happened, not just in the last 64 years, which is my life since I started breathing, or the last 65 years, which is sort of my life back to the point of conception or preconception. And let's forget about the possibilities of reincarnation and what that might or might not be. But even that stuff is totally dependent upon what occurred before I was even born. For example, in my case, I probably wouldn't have been born except for the fact that the Japanese military, civilians, whatever, anyhow, Japan surrendered in 1945. And my father was on his way from Europe, where he'd been in the military, to Japan. And he would have been involved in the invasion of Japan if there hadn't been a surrender. He might have been killed, or he might not have been. You know, he might have come out of it perfectly intact and everything fine in 1949. Meanwhile, I would have not been born in 1946 if that had happened, because there's no way my parents are going to have a child while he was in the military. They're very practical about these kinds of things. Okay, so here's this huge complex of circumstances called the Second World War, which completely determined whether or not I was going to exist in this body or not. And I had nothing to do with it, right? But it was a fundamental feature in the fact that I exist in this way. So my being here has this unbelievable complex relationship to just all kinds of things that occurred in the past. And so then there's off into the future, which certainly is not going to be any less complex than the past. It's going to be equally complex. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine the moment of my death. I can't imagine what's going to happen between now and then or what's going to happen afterwards. I mean, as a Buddhist, I have some ways of thinking about that. But it's all very generic. It's not really very specific. But it's all going to happen. But in the present, I pretty much don't pay any attention to that. Why? Because in the present, I'm into seeing myself as just this. Not a complex that's in the midst of change. I'm just this thing right here. You know, I mean, in the morning, I look in the mirror and I say, how did that happen? I used to be this, you know, young, skinny, energetic guy with a beard and hair on his head and everything, and that's all gone. You know, where did that go? And I will never forget my father when he was in the last month of his life saying, and he was 86 when he died, saying, "It went by so fast. How did that happen?" And everybody apparently says the same thing. It went by so fast. How did that happen? But we totally ignore that, you know, because this is the way our minds work. So this is non-trivial stuff, this notion of we don't see a complex of parts hanging together. We don't see that complex existing in time, and we don't see it as a dynamic system which is undergoing change. I mean, I may not like looking in the mirror and seeing a bald guy who is someplace between size large and extra large. I'd much rather look in the mirror and see my, you know, my 40-year-old self with hair and size small, but that's not the way life is, you know. So this is what I mean by this view is non-trivial. Now there's another part of this though, which is when I do look at myself in the mirror or sitting in a chair reflect on myself or anything else, I immediately apply the label David or me or I to this complex. There isn't a single moment that goes by, generally, of self-reflection when that's not going on. Now, I cannot notice myself as I if I get really involved in work, or some people get involved, really involved in sports or something like that, and their attention is really on something outside that's going on, and they're not paying too much attention to themselves. But, you know, if they start paying attention to themselves, it's David, I, me, immediately. It doesn't take any time. You know, you don't have to stop and reflect on it under most circumstances. Now, there are circumstances when that's not true. For example, if you have a stroke, that's not true. Something happens which is different. But under ordinary circumstances, that's the way it is. And that label, David, or that subjective sense of I or me, is very consistent over time. Even though what it refers to is really different, you know. I mean, I can talk about David 64 in LeGrand, as a kind of techno geek. Or I could talk about, you know, David 40 in San Francisco as a dean, wearing size small. Or I can talk about, you know, David 20 at UCLA trying to figure out what he's going to do with his life, you know, with a nice sharp beard and like, wow, everything is in front of me, you know. Not quite the way it feels right now. But, you know, it's always been David. And it's always been me, and that's never changed. Even though what that label applies to is unbelievably changed, unbelievably inconsistent. And yet, at no point in that whole stream of life has there ever been a difference, one iota of difference, in the way in which David as a label was applied to that stream. And it always seemed exactly the same. And every one of us has this experience of, how did I get to be me in this old body? I don't feel like a me in this old body. I feel like I should be a me in a 20-year-old body, or pick whatever age you like. We all have the same experience, right? I don't think anybody doesn't have that experience. And yet, we don't really dwell deeply on what does this really signify. Because, why? Well, because if we did, it would completely screw up the way in which you go about our daily life. I mean, to put it bluntly, you can't go through your daily life carrying these thoughts in a consistent, ongoing way. You pretty much have to allow yourself to go with the conventions of how people go through life. If you don't do that, then you're like the centipede who stopped to think about how all those 100 legs relate to each other, and pretty soon the centipede falls over. But the problem with that, of course, is unlike centipedes, we're self-reflective. And there's a lot of stuff we care about that's not associated with the ongoing daily life stuff. Okay. So one of the virtues of meditation is taking the time out to reflect in this way and say, what's really going on here? because we can't do it when we're driving down the street. We can't do it when we're working. You know, we can't do it when we're in the middle of some conversation with somebody else. Now, we might be able to cook in a contemplative fashion. We might be able to garden in a contemplative fashion. And I really believe if we're good, we could work in a contemplative fashion. We could teach in a contemplative fashion, so on and so forth. But it's harder. It's harder. But it's doable. Okay. So this way of being, where there's a part of your mind that knows that what you're looking at isn't what's really going on, yet you surrender to the illusion of it, is called conventional reality. It's called conventional reality, conventional truth. And it's one of the two truths in Buddhism. There are two truths in Buddhism, because the other truth in Buddhism is what's the reality there behind the conventional appearance of things. And for most people, the only way to penetrate into that is to stop doing what we're doing, take some time away, and think about this, and then meditate on this. So it's sort of hear the teaching, take some time to hear the teaching, take some time to think about it, take some time to contemplate it, and eventually to begin to see it directly. And when you see it directly, the first thing you begin to see is this dynamic process that's going on. So you can begin to see your body as a dynamic process. You can see your personness as a dynamic process. And the most important thing that you can eventually come to see when you work on it is you can see the way in which your name is labeled on that dynamic process. And that's one of the most important things to do, because what holds the illusion together, or what holds the delusion together, is the label that we attach to this thing that makes it a noun instead of a verb. It's because of our mind's labeling in a certain way. The technical term in Buddhism is designate. We designate a label onto something. We label something. We put a label on something. And having done so, we've converted that verb into a noun. And once we've converted the verb into a noun, we can go about our business in daily life. But when we reconvert that noun to a verb, daily life gets a little bit more complicated. So what meditation is about, and is very importantly about, is taking the time to see the verbness of all the nouns around us. Now, when you begin to spend a lot of time looking at that verbness, then something else starts to happen. Because you see the way that labeling process converts verbs to nouns, processes to things. And this is core in Buddhist thought. You start to see how the labeling, see, I don't mean just think, see how the labeling process, cognize, perceive, how the labeling process converts nouns to verbs, and you can start converting them back and forth because you can watch how the process works. You can actually gain some control over the process. And if you can gain control over the process of the way in which David is designated on this body-mind complex, then really unusual stuff starts to happen. And in the category of really unusual stuff, one thing relates to the habit patterns. Because the habit patterns all arise based upon that fundamental wrong idea of noun instead of verb, thing instead of process. That's the deepest level of confusion. Remember I said there's the problem that puts us in the pickle. Okay, the problem is that we see things instead of processes. The pickle is that we live in a false world of things instead of a true world of processes. So the way to get free of the negative habits and cultivate the positive habits is understand the process nature of things by freeing yourself from the rigid way in which you designate labels onto things. Now, this may seem like a little abstract, but it's real. Yes, Kay?
Yeah, I was just going to say, could you talk a little bit? You've come up to this edge before, and I just want you to take it one step further in terms of you're talking about things and self, but also how about in relationship to other people? Because that's where it's so very important, right?
Well, okay. I mean, for one thing, other people are the same.
Or other creatures.
Mm-hmm. Other people or other creatures are also processes rather than things, but we relate to them as things rather than processes. So, for example, when we run into... Here's a good example. You go to Safeway and you're at the checkout counter and, you know, you're just trying to get all your groceries to the checkout and pay the bill, and you don't want to have a chit-chat with the checkout lady who's absolutely required to be friendly to you whether she likes it or not.
And use your name,
right, because it's, you know, because you're using your discount card, because if you don't use your discount card, this goes on and on. I don't have to, you know, follow this out. And then there's the country music in the background. Let me out of here as quickly as possible, please. Okay, so it's very easy to treat that person as fundamentally not different than the cash register, because they're just part of what's there that you have to get out of. And then on top of that, because they're forced to have a fictitious interaction with you, which you don't want to have with them. You might want to have a real interaction with them, but you don't want to have a fictitious interaction with them. Then you're doubly stuck, but then, of course, they don't want to have a real interaction with you because you're only one of 1,000 people they're going to see that day, and you're probably number 723, and they're pretty tired of it all by now, okay? So, on the other hand, when you see that whole thing, you actually can have a real relationship with them because you understand the dynamics of their situation, which is, hi, I know I'm number 753, and Safeway is forcing you to have this kind of pseudo-friendly relationship with me, and I agree with you, it really sucks. So pretty soon you'll be able to get off work and go home and hang out with your kids, and that'll be great, won't it? Okay, I'll have my change, have a nice day, go out of there. But because you've really seen the situation for what it is, you can actually have a real relationship with them. And I've done this with the Safeway checkers. You know, it's really quite different. And you can do that with anybody under any circumstances. Where it'll get gnarly and challenging, however, is when it's not neutral. Remember last week we were talking, about people that you can have a positive, negative, or neutral relationship with, the people you like, people you're neutral with, people you dislike. We were talking about practicing generosity. Practice generosity with people that you love. No problem. You can imagine them giving them flowers. You can sort of imagine giving flowers to the Safeway checker. You know, pretty hard to imagine giving flowers to your ex-spouse. That's a good one. You know, or your nasty mother, or the person down the street who tromped on your flower bed, or, you know, whatever the case may be. Did that get at what you wanted me to talk about?
I'm getting there. Take a look. Well, just in terms of the perceiving those, just take it to the next step with the enemy. Are somebody perceived as not neutral?
Okay, so when you're perceiving somebody as not neutral, then what's happening, if you're perceiving somebody as an enemy, somebody as hostile to you or something like that, so what's happening is typically you're not seeing them in the context of everything that brought them to the point of being angry and being hostile. Okay. So if you can see that and understand that, then it's pretty hard to have the same kind of reaction to them as if you don't see it. So what perpetuates the ability for anger to circle among people is the unwillingness of people to see where the anger came from, and that the other person has, within the context of their own utterly deluded mind, they have a history which brought them to the point where they're angry. Okay. So when you start seeing them as victims of their deluded minds with a history that brought them to the point of being angry, then you actually do relate to them in a different fashion. It's pretty hard not to. But it's also pretty hard in the context of the toxicness of the angry situation to exercise that level of discrimination and to be free enough to do that. But you can get there. You can practice getting there. It is possible. I'm not saying it's possible because I get there on a frequent basis, but I'm saying it's possible because I think I've gotten there maybe 1 out of 300 times or something like that. Just frequently enough to know that I could get there if I was better at the process. Is that getting closer to what you're talking about?
You know, just experiencing people as things, basically, or boxes, and that there's nothing there. You know, it's just a shell. You're seeing a shell in a particular environment situation, and not seeing everything that brought that person to that point in time. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of danger there. You know, I mean, it just creates unbelievably complex suffering, to engage with a thing rather than a process and have some kind of feeling of that. And I think the first step, the reason David's doing it the way he is because usually you start with something inanimate like a table, then you do it for yourself, and then when you see it in yourself, then it's much more likely that you're going to be able to understand that it's in front of you, too, in other things, so in other beings.
Right, that the same process is going on in Kayla as is going on as David, and therefore the same process is going on. Teresa is going on in Kayla and David, and that sort
right.
of thing.
And it allows compassion. Yeah. I mean, there's it's really a great way to an analytical way, actually, analytical process too, to think about these things, and then what arises spontaneously is the compassion, because it's hard when you see that part of yourself. You know, it's hard not to see that in other. Mm-hmm. people and not feel some kind of care or concern, loving concern.
So then, right, so then to, since this is going on for longer than usual, then to sort of loop back to what brought us to this point, because I'm working on a theme over the course of several talks here, then the wing of compassion, or the five perfections that are associated with being in the conventional world, are all about seeing and working with this dynamic process. Right? They are taking the world, they're being in the world of appearance in a way which cultivates positive habits and does so on the basis of understanding the actual nature of the world of appearance. The sixth perfection, the perfection of wisdom, is the condition of mind which allows you to perform this analysis. So the way that the two fit together is the condition of mind called wisdom, which understands things as they really are, is the cognitive tool which gives you the rational understanding of why you practice in this way. And why you practice in this way is because you're able to understand the dynamics of what's going on in this large-scale process, and recognize that your relationship to this process is such that you have the choice and the ability to create a future from this point on where something is going to happen different than it would happen if you were blindly driven by negative emotions. That you can, in every moment of every interaction and every situation, to the extent you have cultivated some wisdom mind, you're capable of making the decision to do what you think is going to have a positive outcome. So you can go to the checkout counter in Safeway and say, this is my opportunity to practice and have a relationship with the checker, which is, this person is not a computer. This is a human being. I have a relationship with them. And when I walk away from the checkout counter here with my groceries, they can feel better, incrementally, tiny bit better than they did before I went through the process. Of course, it may not work. And, you know, you may say something that you think is nice and friendly, and they may get pissed off at you. You know, it's not, you're not, quote, God, unquote, that you can guarantee that, you know, the outcome that you're going to want to have happen is the outcome that's going to happen. But that doesn't change anything. You still have the ability to do that. And you have that ability in every given moment if you're willing to take it. Now, that's a real challenge. There's no question about the fact that that's a real challenge. And fundamentally, what Buddhism does is it dumps an incredible load of responsibility on you if you really accept Buddhist perspective on reality. And that incredible load is total freedom. But you have to choose that. It's totally your responsibility to choose freedom or choose bondage in any given moment. Because in every given moment, you accumulate downstream consequences. That's why it's a heavy responsibility. There's nobody else doing this but you, and there's no moment when it's not happening. So when you see that, that's pretty weighty. On the other hand, because that's the truth of things as you see it, therein is the capacity to be utterly free, because you can create lots of positive outcomes. And you recognize that in any given moment, you have the ability to be free in that moment or not. That's your choice. Freedom comes with responsibility. Responsibility comes with freedom. We're all adults. Why would that be a surprise? You know, it'd be a surprise to kids, not to adults. But we've done a good job of convincing ourselves none of that stuff is true, because it is a bit on the weighty side. So that's enough for tonight. I'll come back to this again tomorrow, 2 weeks from now.